The Guardian.
This is the Guardian Books Podcast from the Edinburgh International Book Festival.
It's fun to be around people who are here because they love books and they love to read.
Getting to meet authors and hear authors talking about writing is just lovely.
I'll see Alistair Gray today, and then I'm in line now to hopefully see Neil Gaiman, if I can get tickets for that.
We've been to see The Gruffalo just now.
Yes, we've got tickets to see Marshmallow Sky with Kathy Cassidy.
Fleck, the play at the end of the festival by Alistair Gray.
Being able to hang around and meet interesting people, and everyone's got their own take on everything, so it's quite an inspiring place to be, I think.
Because this is all in a big square, you feel like you're really together with everybody.
I'm here with my wife. I've lost her.
So here we are, surrounded by books and book lovers, authors and illustrators. Edinburgh is mercifully dry for the moment, and there's a warm atmosphere in the marquees of Charlotte Square Gardens as people queue for tickets and events or recline in deck chairs with newly signed novels. I'm Sarah Crown, and this is the first of our podcasts from the Edinburgh International Book Festival. Coming up, we'll be speaking to Sebastian Barry and Jackie Kay. As we'll hear, the question of identity plays a strong part in their recent work, as does the human history of the 20th century. Already this weekend, we've heard from Alistair Gray, Tom McCarthy, Alan Warner and Julia Donaldson, among many others, and I've been battling through a library's worth of books for these podcasts. But one of my colleagues has already gone native.
I'm Charlotte Higgins. I'm the chief arts writer at The Guardian, and I've been up in Edinburgh now for almost 10 days. It's as if no other world exists for me. Everything else seems like a distant memory. So I've been rushing around the fringe, watching lots of theatre mainly, and writing and interviewing. It's been lots of fun. The book festival's a bit different from other parts of Edinburgh in the month of August because it has a little sense of community all of its own. For a start, it's geographically delineated. It's in Charlotte Square. It has its own geographical place. Everything else is spread willy-nilly around the whole city. It's a really nice contrast to the rest of the festival. If you're looking for something fresh to do at Edinburgh Book Festival, something you wouldn't necessarily imagine that you'd want to do, I've got a special technique for you, which is not to necessarily look at the writers or authors, but to look at who's chairing the event. Edinburgh Book Festival has got some really excellent chairs. So I would say that anything that Alan Little, the BBC News correspondent, chairs is worth seeing. He's an absolutely wonderful maker of an event, and he's been involved in programming a little stream of events that are around the idea of revolution. So he's talking to some really interesting Arab and Chinese writers, and he'll really bring the idea of the book festival into the news agenda, if you like. Another chair that I would absolutely look out for is Stuart Kelly, who is the literary editor of the Scotland on Sunday, and a very clever man indeed. Last year, he did an absolute blinder of an event with A.S. Byatt, and he's chairing her again this year. I think the best events at a literary festival are those where you feel that you're actually eavesdropping on a very interesting and clever conversation between two people, and Stuart absolutely does that. I am sorry to report that although I am now sitting in the street and I'm not soaking wet, that is a rare window. It has been pouring with rain. So just be prepared. Other than that, bring your brain and feisty appetite for culture of all kinds.
Jackie Kay is a poet and a novelist who last year became a memoirist as well with the publication of Red Dust Road, an account of her journey to rediscover the biological parents who abandoned her as a baby. But she's in Edinburgh to talk about her poetry and her latest collection, Fury, is a companion volume to Red Dust Road. Hi, Jackie.
Hello. Hi, Claire.
Tell us first, what does Fury mean? I had a big debate with myself as to how it was pronounced. Did I pronounce it correctly?
You pronounce it the way that I pronounce it, which is Fury. I think the old Scots pronunciation of it is Fear, and it's in Robert Burns' So Gie's a Hand, My Trusty Fear, and Here's a Hand of Thine. But I make it Fury in my poems to rhyme with lots of it's easier for rhymes.
And scansion as well.
And scansion. And also it sounds more like friend to me, so I'm hoping that this pronunciation will catch up. Because Fiery sounds like Deary and it sounds friendlier, whereas Fear sounds sort of oddly Germanic in a way. But it's the old Scots word for friend, which Joe, my Joe, is also an old Scots word for friend. And we get it in New Year. So here's a hand, my trusty Fear, and gie's a hand of thine. We'll tack a right good willy wacht for auld lang syne.
I said it's a companion volume to Red Dust Road. What does that mean?
Well, it's the first time that I've done it. I think what happened to me when I was writing Red Dust Road, lots of things occurred to me that weren't part of the memoir, that couldn't be written about in prose, that they were poems. And so I was writing poems on that journey as well. And it seemed to me that the poems and the prose started to have a kind of a conversation with each other. So for me, a companion volume means two books that are actually having a conversation with each other. If you read them both separately, hopefully you'll get something. But if you read them together, you'll get something more because there's a dialogue going on between them. And the dialogue is a dialogue mainly between poetry and prose. And also it begs the question, you know, why do you write some things in poems and some things in prose? And what's the difference between the two? I don't know all the logical answers to these, but I know that there must be some difference for me to be able to write, for instance, Burying My African Father as a poem. I couldn't write that as a piece of prose.
Why don't you read Burying My African Father and we'll see what you mean.
Okay. Burying My African Father. Now that I have walked all the way down the red dust road and into Nzakha and seen the lizard and geckos and goats and all God's creatures, and walk beside the elephant grasses, the plantain, banana and cassava, through the gate of your compound, past the sign that read, Barbing Saloon Here, and held the tiny two-week-old baby of your second cousin, and said Odi Ma to her shy Kedu, and stood outside your house and peered through the shutters, and in the hotel room I remembered you well, spinning and praying years ago in Abuja, when you told me you wouldn't reveal the name of your village, your sons or your daughter. Now that I have finally arrived without you to the home of the ancestors, I can bid you farewell, adieu, for I must, with my own black pen instead of a spade, ashes to ashes and dust to dust, and years before you're actually dead, bury you right here in my head.
Well, that sent a chill down my spine. So why did you want to bury him?
I know. I think I was talking about imagination and how you, for years and years when you're adopted and you have birth parents, you have a kind of an imaginary relationship with them. You make up an imaginary father. And my mum used to always say, I'm picturing a cross between Paul Robeson and Nelson Mandela. And so I always imagined this kind of fantasy figure. And then when I met him, he was kind of born again Christian, very zealous, and wasn't interested really in me at all, and didn't want to tell any of his family about me, wanted to keep me completely secret. So the reality was really very different from the imagination. And so in that poem, I'm talking about imaginatively burying him, instead of continually having this imaginative version of him in my head, it's talking about trying to lay that to rest, really, mm-hmm. and move on. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't really find a way to write that in prose because it's too difficult. Whereas in a poem, you can do that. And also, it was a kind of a nod to Seamus Heaney's poem about digging and the pen and the spade. I quite like the idea of taking that, you know, with the pen, with my own pen instead of a spade, that I'm burying him. It's just about how powerful the imagination can be in those situations.
Now, you mentioned your mum there, and your mum is your adopted mum. That's the person who you call mum, not your mother, who you also discover in the course of Red Dust Road, the memoir.
Yes, no, exactly. My mum, I always kind of distinguish, and I expect everybody to know this, but they don't. But I always call my mum, my adoptive mum, my mum, and my adoptive dad, my dad, and my birth mother, I say birth mother and birth father, because the formality of it seems fitting, because my mum and my dad are the people that I'm really close to. They're my real parents, and they're the ones that brought me up, and they're the people that I feel I owe everything to, whereas my birth mother and birth father are more formal in my life. They're not so real. They're related to me through DNA, but I've realised how random DNA is. It feels that nurture for me has been much more crucial in my life than nature, and it's been interesting to just be on that journey.
Mm-hmm. Your mum has been very encouraging about you seeking out your birth parents, but your dad hasn't really, has he always?
No, my mum has always been curious about the stories of her children. Both me and my brother are adopted, and she's always sort of been really interested in trying to imagine what our parents would be like, and always felt a great sense of gratitude, you know, like she would like to meet them because she'd like to say thank you for bringing me our Jackie, you know, because she always says things like, face it, her loss is my gain.
Oh, that's so adorable.
I know, things like that, which is really quite moving. And my dad doesn't really particularly like to think about us as being adopted at all, because he thinks of us so firmly as his children that it's kind of a bit irritating to have any mention or reminder of us being adopted. Though, of course, he knows that as a fact. He doesn't particularly like to mention it. So he'll say, you know, he got to a bit in my book where I said that he was threatened by me finding my Nigerian father, and he said, and why would I be threatened when I wasn't threatened when you found your mother and she's over here and he's all the way in Nigeria? And my mum said, because it's another father, John. And he said, well, can you put in, my dad disputes this? So he would dispute that he minds, but I kind of know that he does.
The way you speak is very Scottish, and that's one of the things that feeds into Fiery. Half of it is Scottish and half of it is about Nigeria. Would you just read us a poem which captures the Scottishness?
Yes, indeed. This wee one's really about what I was talking about earlier, having fantasy versions of your mother and father, and then when you meet them turning out not to be true. And quine and loon are old Aberdonian words for boy and girl. Granite. I found the quine and I found the loon in the sparkling granite toon, just as a hare was coming doon, just as a cloud had slayed the moon. The feather's face is set in stain, the mither cries and is all alane. I've wandered richt up Gaelic Lane, doon Union Street and back again. Just as granite comes frae grain, gin there'll be grown folk searching vain, tracking doon the past in the rain. As long as you'd call a stain a stain.
This is a book that has a glossary in the back of translations of words, both from Igbo and from Scottish. I found that very amusing.
I found it amusing. That was quite one of the best bits in the book for me, is writing the glossary. It was quite fun.
So, for example, in Burying My Dead Father, you have Odi Ma. What does that mean?
It means fine, thank you. If somebody says to you, Kedu, which means how are you, then you'll reply, Odi Ma, fine, thank you.
Now, this podcast has played a little bit of a role in your voyage of discovery, hasn't it, of the rest of your family members?
Yes, well, it's been an amazing time for me recently, because recently I found my sisters, or rather they found me. They found me in a strange way. They listened to the podcast that I had made about meeting my birth mother and realised that it was their mother. And they had no idea that I was their sister. They thought I was a church pen pal. So they rushed out and they got a copy of Red Dust Road. And my sister said to me, it's so strange to have my memories in your words. And so that's just been quite an amazing experience. Really, I feel really lucky. I feel almost as if my book's got extra chapters added on in the end that haven't been written, but that have happened. And I feel very lucky that the book's actually, and The Guardian, has actually helped me find my sisters.
And just finally, you're up for the Scottish Book Award, aren't you, at the end of the festival? Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's really interesting this year because the Scottish Book Award for the first time is open to the public vote. So they've been having people vote from over 30 countries on all four different categories of the book. There's the memoir, poetry, first novel and novel. And the whole thing will be announced, the winner, on the 26th of August. And the winner gets a whopping 30 grand.
Oh, my goodness.
Which is quite a load of money.
That will take you to Nigeria a few times, wouldn't it? To rediscover all those other relatives.
It would pay the visa bill. Yes, it would. It would be great.
Thank you very much, Jackie.
Thanks.
Guilty pleasures. Sometimes I feel a slight guilt to go back to the books I loved as a child. They're just William stories. Richmond Crompton.
Oh, young adult fiction. Sarah Dresser. There are lots of them.
Oh, Stephen King. Definitely. He writes a cracking good story, but it's really very embarrassing to have to admit to it.
My guilty reading pleasure is probably going to be the Harry Potter series.
Yeah, chick lit. I do like chick lit, which is a bit trashy.
My guilty pleasure is Dick Francis, and I have never been to a racecourse in my life, but he actually is a very good writer.
Cycling magazines. That's my guilty pleasure. The other day in one of these cycling magazines, I saw an advert for a used tandem. Great condition, one previous owner. And I thought, one.
Sebastian Barry won the Costa Book of the Year award with his last novel, The Secret Scripture, but has so far failed to win the Booker Prize despite being shortlisted twice. This year, he's back in contention with On Canaan's Side, which was named as one of the Booker Dozen last month, and critics think this time he may well be in with a chance. The novel tells the story of Lily, whose life spans the 20th century. After fleeing the sectarian skirmishes in Ireland after the First World War, she arrives in America only to find that violence has tracked her across the ocean.
I saw a queer blaze of whiteness and redness, as if quite unconnected to the noise, but not unconnected because it was flames and noise issuing from a gun barrel, existing just for a breathless instant, then gone, but never gone, never gone again, and the muddle of the gun in the man's hand and some bullet bursting into my thigh, into his side, where his heart lay hidden so that his whole body went banging against the wall just under the fatal portrait. Like a lorryman had thrown a sack of loose grain to the floor, he folded at the waist, and on his poor jacket, all under the arm, was a surprising hole, or maybe a bullet hole and a flower of blood, I didn't know. And in that fraction of time, in that clumsy, merciless falling, I saw life pulled out of him. I saw the face grow ashen, grow dark. I threw myself at his body. I held his face. I kissed his face. I begged him to return to me. I begged him. I begged him, but he could not. I expected my own bullet then, in the moment following, the back of my head tensed to receive it. I wasn't sure if I had a terror of that. I just thought it would come, but it did not.
Sebastian Barry reading from On Canaan's Side, and I started by asking how good news from the Booker Prize Committee affects a writer.
The bringing out of books is a form of non-physical boxing of some sort. There's a ring element to it, and the crowd around the ring, and there's the other mysterious, unknown boxer who gets in the ring with you. Your psychotherapist is working overtime to try to keep you sane. So a releasing piece of news like that. I live in Wicklow. I live in the remote mountains of Wicklow. We do have a phone service. So a piece of news like that coming in from far away London. I don't really know anyone in London. I keep it as an epic place. I keep it in my mind almost in a child's fairy tale sense. So when I get news like that, it's very freeing. That's what it is. In the last few years, going to events, you know, doing readings, has been incredibly heartening, actually, because the readers that we now have this incredible connection with online as well. This is such a new thing, and I think it would probably have an effect even on how people write, actually. It's just the warmth of people, the grace of people.
I live in Wicklow, which is where the roots of the book are, I suppose. Lily, your main character, that's where she comes from, where her family comes from. And actually, of course, it's a family that we've met before in your fiction, isn't it? The Duns. You've written about them before. Why did you decide to go back to these people?
Because I wanted to meet them, in a way. I wanted to gather them back.
This is essentially the story of Lily, and it's also the story of the 20th century in a way, and of her movement through it, as you say, starting off in Ireland, fleeing this sentence that's imposed on her and her husband in the novel, turning up in America, ending up in Chicago, and seeing, you know, the person who becomes her husband in the novel being gunned down in front of her. And one of the things that I thought about it was that it really brings to the surface the fact that the 20th century was one of conflict from beginning to end, because the book, well, it's not chronological, but it ends and also begins with the death of her grandson, Bill, who was fighting with the American army.
Yeah. Do you know, because we were young in that century, some of us younger than others, I was 45 when it turned, but we didn't live through some of those things, the first half especially. So in a way, the condition of my parents' generation was to some degree unexplained. But you're absolutely right. If you think back of it, not only 1916, the War of Independence in Ireland, the Civil War, that great unspoken war, but also, of course, the Spanish Civil War, and just after the First World War, and then the Second World War, and then the Stalin purges, and then... So no wonder they were the way they were. No wonder Sartre was talking about being in nothingness. No wonder there was existentialism. No wonder they were talking about the death of history, the death of love. And there was an enormous dislocation, I think, in that 50s generation. My father's best friend had been in a concentration camp as a child, you know, and was now a young man in London. And there was a wildness in those people. And they were not actually gearing themselves up for parenting, particularly. You know, it is true, we acknowledge the nature of the history, but sometimes we forget the actual psychiatry of that century and what it did to generations and what people had to go through. And if you have a book of a woman 70 years, 80 years, 8 decades of her life, in the short period of a book, there's a slight concertina effect on it. It's not just the Kennedys who suffered so grievously in the century, especially in the 60s, but there's a lot of individuals who have been through hoops of fire. And what I find poignant about them and deeply valuable about them is that no one knows the personal histories, the legion, the numberless infinity of souls, as Don says, of people who suffered through that century.
And almost the amazing thing about Lily is that she manages to retain her warmth and her humanity, her sense of herself as a lucky individual, I suppose, and despite all the horrible things that she experiences, right up to the point where her grandson dies. And I wondered why it was this that pushes her over the edge, because the book is you know, in one sense, an extended suicide note, isn't it?
She I suppose it is, but not to anyone, to herself, which is... It is a long note to herself, but it's also, you know, my instinctive feeling is that we do not know ourselves really till we write ourselves down. So she wonders, should she be justifiably alive when her grandson has been taken? That is it. She is 89. Lily's idea is not so much to take her life out of sheer grief and an inability to live. Her question is one of justice. If this great injustice of history has been done to her, this rather mindless, brainless little dance of history has occurred to her grandson, then she is not sure that beauty will be kept intact by her still being here. She's trying to restore something in a way by removing herself. I mean, our great guide for that century is Primo Levi, when he's writing Ecce Homo, and he's showing you those tiny instances of kindness in the camps or whatever. Those tiny instances that may seem tiny are in fact, you know, the deepest poetry of the human world. It's the true history of mankind. It's in large the part that doesn't get written.
One of the things that's particularly interesting to me as a reader of the book was that great lightning that occurs. Despite everything that you know as a student, the history of the 20th century is going to happen when she flees from America. What she is doing is what you're doing as a writer as well. You're leaving behind writing about Ireland and crossing the Atlantic and writing about the new
Jordan
country.
As well.
Yes, well, yes, referring to the title. And I wondered what the draw of writing about America was, because you seem to take this almost visceral pleasure in describing, you know, the streets of New York and Lillian Tadgett as salmon swimming.
I was like a hungry wolf with my own memories of America. I was like the bear, actually, when I got into that room full of honey. I feared it, though, because I thought maybe it would be a depopulated landscape. Maybe it would be an empty landscape. Maybe it would be empty rooms. Irish people, in a sense, sometimes go to America to reach home. It's a kind of an inverse journey of some sort. All our mythology is not Cú Chulainn, you know. I wish it was, Mr. Yeats, and I do, but it's not. It's the Marx Brothers. An infinite number of things that you don't even know are there. That gallery of paintings, that world of literature. So when I got there, I felt like a poor traveller. You know, I wasn't travelling first class in any way. But I did feel that by accident I had gathered this little bag of things that I didn't even know I had to hand. But it was a sort of an intoxication then, because you might say I sort of went native in America once I got in there, you know, and loved everything and was excited to kind of go to America while still sitting in Wicklow in some strange way. No, it was interesting because I often fear the book tours in America, because it's so deracinating in many ways, so disorientating, an endless sequence of hotels, and you can love nothing. But now I'm quite looking forward to going on the book tour in September, because I think, oh no, this is sort of home now, because I've made a hope to some degree, even ineptly, that I've brought Lily home. And in another mad way, a secret hope is that I've made the map of America more familiar to me, so I'll be less afraid of it and more in love with it.
Sebastian Barry. On Thursday, we'll have our next podcast from the Edinburgh International Book Festival, where we'll be going gothic with Karen Russell, Richard T. Kelly and Kevin McNeil. And Louise Welsh will take us on a walking tour of Edinburgh's many gothic haunts. Until then, goodbye and thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.